Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends. Even better, you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. If you're like me, then you have different family members who have different ailments, and I've recommended Mood to all of them. I legitimately, before recording this, I told my mom about Mood, and she's going to make her first order. Because they have gummies for all sorts of things, for pain relief, for sleeping, for just improving your mood. Their gummies are specially blended and each one feels different. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out in 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I wake up feeling amazing. And each gummy is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S., so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Here are a few things that I'm getting. Unlock the Beer Escape Room. It's a cute little cage that you could put a six-pack of beer in, and then you have to do an escape room to get the code to open the cage. I am absolutely getting this for my brother-in-law because this is in his wheelhouse in every way. The DIY Root Beer Science Kit I'm getting for my 8-year-old because he has recently discovered root beer and he likes learning. So this is going to be a really fun project for the both of us. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ATTWG. That's uncommongoods.com/ATTWG for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. You are told your health starts in your gut, but if you're a woman, it all starts with your hormones. When your hormones are off, everything is off, including digestive issues, mood, mental clarity, energy levels, weight management, and so much more. As the new year approaches, imagine hitting refresh and supporting your body with optimal hormone balance. Hormone Harmony is a game changer for women struggling with hormonal imbalances that leave them exhausted both physically and mentally. It only contains science-based ingredients that bring back comfort, energy, clarity, confidence, and a sense of balance. Perfect for enjoying the holidays and heading into the new year energized. Happy Mammoth, the company behind this, has helped over 2.4 million women get their lives back and feel like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use code ATTWG. On August 13, 2018, 34-year-old Shanann Watts returned to her Frederick, Colorado home from a weekend business trip. She was coming back to her husband, 33-year-old Chris Watts, and their two daughters, 4-year-old Bella and 3-year-old Cece. Though she didn't arrive home until nearly 2 a.m., Shanann was supposed to be up bright and early for a 9 a.m. doctor's visit, but when she didn't show up, her friend, Nicole Atkinson, who's actually the one who drove her home, sounded the alarm. And what followed was an intense missing persons investigation that only lasted about 3 days before the public and Shanann's family found out the horrible truth of what had happened to her. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Hello and welcome to our first bonus episode between seasons one and two. As we said in our last episode, we were going to be taking a break a little bit, and we are. But we do want to bring a few episodes that have kind of different formats and, you know, are not quite what we normally do during this season. This week, we're actually doing something where we're talking about a Netflix documentary that I'm sure most of you have seen by now. It's called American Murder, The Family Next Door. And this is about the Shanann Watts, Cece Watts, and Bella Watts murder.
Right. So spoiler alert, if you have not seen that Netflix special, please turn this episode off and go and watch that Netflix special, because though I'm sure most of our listeners have already seen it, if you have not, we are not going to hold anything back. We are going to just leave all the spoilers out there. So again, Go and watch the Netflix special. It will make a whole lot more sense if you watch that and then listen to this episode.
Yep. But so just a quick background on the case. For those of you who may not have followed it a couple of years ago, because like you actually didn't know much about this, did you?
No, I didn't.
Which is crazy because it was huge.
I had nothing. Yeah. I had no idea about it.
Yeah. So what's interesting is I actually, before I watched the Netflix documentary, I knew the basics of the case, but I hadn't watched or read much about it. And the reason is because it was involving child murders, which is something that I tend to try to stay away from. And especially at that time when this happened, our youngest had just turned a year old, or was just getting ready to turn a year old. And it just was not something I could deal with at all mentally. So up until this and even when the documentary came out, and part of the reason why we're talking about this like 2 months after it came out is because it actually did take me a while before I even decided to watch it. So anyway, I watched this. It's one of the things that I do when you're away normally. Like, I watch all of my murder shows.
You watch murder shows thinking about how I'm going to kill you?
Okay, well, we will get to that for sure. So, like, trust me, that's definitely a part of this. But no, I do because, you know, like in any marriage, we have the shows that we watch together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are usually together. So when we're not, it's like this whole delicate balance of trying to find something to watch that you don't think the other one would want to watch so they won't be mad at you.
It's much easier for me if I do anything historical or
sci-fi
or war based, yeah. Like that's
any period, anything.
Yeah, it's easy for me to find something. I mean,
yeah, you know. But it's harder for me, and so but I can always. That's why I usually turn to murder shows. And so that's what I do, like when you're at work and I'm working from home and I need something in the background or whatever. But in this particular case, you were out of town for work. So I had like time, like after the kids went to bed, I had just, you know, all this time to actually watch shows and I didn't know what to do with myself. So I finally, after hearing so many amazing things about this documentary, I broke down and watched it. And I'm really glad I did. Now, just, you know, For those of you who aren't my family, which is, you know, definitely I do have a lot of family who listen to this, but
that's like 90% of our audience. It's, I know, totally, right? Fine.
One of my many, many jobs that I've had was I was a TV recapper. I was like an internet TV recapper in the early to mid 2000s, or I guess mid to late 2000s. And I saw this documentary and my recapper brain like immediately turned back on, because the way this was made is so interesting and such an amazing way to make a documentary that while I was watching it, like I was texting you and I was like, listen, I'm watching this. You have to see it.
Yeah. And the minute I saw it, I mean, it blew me away.
It's so fascinating because I've
I've never seen a crime documentary that had this much kind of first-person, real-time access. I mean, the very beginning of it, the very first scene is from their doorbell video camera.
Yes.
And then the scenes that follow are from police body cams. And so you're seeing this missing persons case unfold in real time. And, you know, we talk about missing persons cases. And, you know, of course, the first thing you talk about is, like, where were they last seen? And you literally see, like, where they were last seen. You see her on her doorbell camera coming home from this business trip. And you know, because of the timestamps, exactly when that was. It was 1:48 a.m. Right. It wasn't like, oh, around 1:30, maybe closer to 2. It was 1:48 a.m. And this technology, because, you know, this isn't the only kind of surveillance footage, if you want to call it that, that comes into play. Like, this plus the body cams, it just is able to tell the story in such a unique and fascinating way.
And let me first off say, like, a huge kudos to the Frederick, Colorado Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the unprecedented access that they gave to the documentarians is amazing. Seeing the footage, I completely understand why they did it.
Because they look good.
Oh, my God. I mean, if you want to have a missing persons investigation, you know, 101, look at this.
Yeah, and I do want to talk to you a lot about the police response to this, because I think that's a really interesting part of this whole story.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, because really, you know, you have a missing persons case that's solved in 3 days.
Yeah.
And that's not always what happens, as we've seen. I mean, we cover exclusively unsolved missing persons cases.
And this very easily could have gone down that same path. Nobody would have found.
Yeah, for sure. Now, while the Frederick Police Department did do an excellent job, like, I don't want to understate that. I also don't want to understate what a dumb shit Chris Watts is.
Yes. Yeah, so, absolutely.
I mean, we really need to talk about what a fucking idiot Chris Watts is.
And we'll delve into the psychology behind all of that.
Yeah. And you know, so this obviously, this episode's different. I mean, one, because for the first time, you actually knew what we were talking about before we started recording.
Yeah.
Like, we're kind of on the same page. You actually took notes. I don't have any notes for this. Like, you're the one who's coming.
Oh, no, I totally took notes.
Yeah, you're the one who's coming prepared. I'm not. But, you know, I did still do a little bit of research just to get some information about the case that wasn't covered in the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one thing that I have learned is that, you know, Chris Watts has a lot of fans and a lot of, like, you know, people who think he's, like, innocent or acted in a way that was somehow justified. And I'm just going to say right up front, like, no, if that's, like, your deal, like, I'm not entertaining. I'm not entertaining that.
No, and if you are a listener of ours.
Yeah.
And this is a case you have followed and you think Chris Watts is innocent, you're out of your fucking mind.
Yeah. Like,
sorry.
Also, this episode is going to have a lot more swears than most of our episodes, but that's because Chris Watts fucking sucks and, like, everybody needs to know that. As I mentioned in the intro, Shanann Watts lived in Frederick, Colorado. So she and her husband, Chris, married in 2012, and they had two daughters, as I mentioned. You know, things for them weren't always easy. They got married, you know, in North Carolina, where they're both from. So they, you know, are both from the East Coast, moved all the way to Colorado, kind of left both of their families mm-hmm. behind. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think they really knew anyone when they moved. And it was a big leap of faith. But I think they were ready for a change. So Shanann had been married previously, which is touched upon briefly in the documentary. She was divorced in 2009. So she got married, like, super, super young.
Yeah.
And it obviously didn't last long. So this was her second marriage. Now, Chris, you know, in doing a little bit of, like I said, I did a little bit of background research just to get a little more information outside of the documentary. Chris was about a year younger than Shanann and was a very quiet, very introverted person. And like everybody who knew him said that. I mean, you know, football coach, like friends, everybody. He really stuck to himself. He has a sister, an older sister who was kind of more of the social butterfly type, who had, you know, tons of friends, tons of boyfriends, stuff like that. But he didn't. He said he didn't have a girlfriend like the entire time he was in high school. There were probably some underlying self-esteem issues there, but for the most part, he was just quiet. Like everybody said he was super nice. Like he was just known as a very sweet, genuine guy, very intelligent, apparently had a photographic memory. They got married, they moved to Colorado, but things were kind of bumpy because they didn't actually have like jobs when they moved to Colorado, it sounds like.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so it was kind of tough for them to get started. And
so why did they move out there though?
I forget. Like, I actually did read that at one point. It was like, I think one of them visited one time. I think Shanann visited one time and thought it was like really cool and just got him to move out there.
Well, that also goes with a lot of my theories, but yeah. Go ahead.
So they went out there and at one point they both worked in sales at a Ford dealership. And I think that's really interesting because Shanann, her personality is definitely sales oriented.
Yes.
And I actually read something that it was, I think it was on Reddit, but like they found reviews from the dealership where she worked and she had like glowing customer reviews. Like loved her, thought she was a great salesperson and was wonderful. And yeah, and Chris worked there too, which I do find interesting because he is such an introvert. Not to say, like, so I'm in a sales position, I'm in real estate, and I'm an introvert, and for years, I did think those two things were mutually exclusive.
Oh, they're totally not, though.
Yeah, well, as I found, like, I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think they do have very different personalities, and I don't know how successful he was at that, but in any case, neither one of them stayed in those positions, and so Chris eventually started working for Anadarko Petroleum, which is where he was working at the time of the disappearance. And Shanann had been working, like basically like answering phones at a children's hospital. In 2013, they bought their house, which is this gigantic, like 4,000 square foot.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, this huge home. But God bless Colorado real estate prices. They bought it for like $400,000 in 2013. But yeah, so they bought this house and they had the house, they had cars, and Shanann became pregnant with Bella. So she was born in December of 2013. So all this kind of happened in the same year. And so what it sounds like is Shanann got pregnant and was like, we have to buy a house. And then they bought this huge house.
Which is amazing. I mean, Shanann had lupus. She talked about this in the documentary about how the doctors were telling her very early on that she was not going to be able to conceive.
Right. And that is a common thing with lupus is that it can be very hard to conceive. And so, yeah, so she was, you know, thrilled when she became pregnant. They got this house. But, you know, they weren't actually in the financial place to live the American dream that they were trying to live at the time. In 2015, that's when Cece was born. But that same year, the pair actually declared bankruptcy. So this wasn't covered in the documentary. But it came down to the fact that while Chris, you know, had a good job at the time, and you know, Shanann was working at the children's hospital, she was doing pretty well too. They were kind of just living above their means. So they had a high mortgage payment. Mm-hmm. And they had two car payments and, you know, they just couldn't juggle it all. And they had a ton of debt from their wedding and other things. And it just became a bit overwhelming. So they were really trying to achieve this outward appearance of this upwardly mobile, successful family. And they couldn't back it up. Right. And I think that's kind of what we see throughout the story. Shadan eventually started working for a company called Laval. And what that is an MLM, a multi-level marketing company. And they sold several products. And what they're known for is a product called Thrive. And this is basically like a wellness, health and wellness kind of supplement. It's supposed to increase your energy, help you lose weight, things like that. And they have patches that you put on. That's the weird patches okay. that you saw. Yes.
So like
that's
throughout the documentary. Mm-hmm.
They're all wearing both weird patches.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And you even see it, and I didn't notice it before when we were rewatching it. Nicole, her friend, had one on her hand.
Oh, yeah. I did not notice that on her
because
friend.
Because Nicole, worked for them too because they were on that trip. Yeah.
Okay.
So it does appear that Shanann did do well at this because the business trip that she was on the weekend of August 13th, 2018 was a trip to Arizona that was paid for by Laval. It was paid for by her company. And that's not the first one. I mean, her Facebook is full of, all these crazy trips that she got to go on because of this company. And, you and I have friends who are reps at similar companies mm-hmm. and the same thing. I mean, I've seen pictures of like, oh, I'm in Cancun and, for a retreat or whatever, I'm in Nashville for this, that, or the other. So that's a pretty common thing. But, it's not like everybody goes and does that. So you kind of have to be at a certain point in that company.
Right. No, absolutely. But, and that brings us to another point.
Her Facebook presence.
In this story. Yes. Her online presence. And I specifically wanted you to comment on this because if you're not in this field,
you might not understand. And I think, and when I started watching the documentary, which is largely made up of her Facebook posts and videos.
Yeah.
I immediately keyed into what was going on, but I feel like a lot of people wouldn't.
Right. Exactly. I know you understand it
mm-hmm.
from a perspective of an online business presence,
mm-hmm.
but the majority of people would think, and this is what came out in the media at the time
mm-hmm.
was that she was being a megalomaniac.
Yeah, and a narcissist.
And a narcissist, yeah. which is 100% not true.
Right.
She was highlighting the best parts of what was going on in her life to advocate her business.
Yeah. Any part of being a small business owner at this point is having a very large social media presence. People like to see who you are, and any coach or anyone will tell you, and again, it doesn't have to be an MLM. It's like any business. They will tell you that your audience, your potential customers, whoever, want to feel like you're being authentic. They want to know who you are. They want to know about your life. And so there's this thing where you feel like you have to kind of let people in. And I think different business owners do it to different degrees. And when you have these online companies, and I don't know anything about the inner workings of Thrive, but what I do know is that a lot of these will kind of give you examples of things to post, and they'll give you guidance on what to post. And they will tell you like, hey, show your family, show your busy life, and like try to connect it to the product. I mean, because she would talk about her lupus, it was like, I had no energy, like I have this illness and then
she was advocating the products mm-hmm. that helped her with that.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, I have absolutely done this to an extent. I mean, I have taken videos of us apple picking and put it on my business page.
Or dying Easter eggs.
Dying Easter eggs. Absolutely.
Hey, look, 100%. I did not want to be in any of those videos. I also don't want to be in any future videos, but hey, I will acquiesce to whatever you want.
And I don't do it that often.
No, but you don't. We have mentioned this before. I am like a grandfather when it comes to internet in any
You don't
capacity.
Know the internet. You don't understand.
Look, I only got Twitter to promote this podcast.
Yeah.
And I have like 26 followers. So I I'm pretty sure they're all your friends. So I'm just like double promoting to people that already know about the podcast. You are existing in a world, even though we are the same age, you are existing in a world that is well outside of my understanding.
Yeah. And it's outside of a lot of people's understanding. But that's why I did want to talk to it, because I think that Shanann has been judged a lot for what she put out on Facebook.
Unfairly and harshly, I think.
Yeah. And while the things that she posted, it's not necessarily what I would post. Like, I would not have made the same decisions she made. I get where it's coming from. And where it's ultimately coming from is she was trying to provide for her family.
Right.
You know, they had had an unstable financial past. She was trying to step it up and provide something for her family. And whether you agree with the, like, her methods or not, it doesn't matter. You know, that's what this was. This isn't her just being a narcissist. This isn't her just feeling the need to like put every second of her life on Facebook. You know, I mean, yeah, you can be cynical and say like, well, you shouldn't use your family that way. But like, listen, we all got to eat. Like, she was doing what she was doing to grow a business. So Shanann's intense Facebook presence, it was business related and it was part of her job. So I think it's funny that you admitted that you didn't want to be in my videos, which is fine because Chris obviously also did not want to be in those videos. I think it's very clear that he was like kind of gamely going along with it.
Yeah.
But was not actually interested in it at all. But like you understand why I'm doing it. And I think he understood why she was.
Yeah, totally. I mean, whatever it takes to grow your business.
Yeah.
I understand that. I think Chris probably understood
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I think he did.
Yeah.
And while Chris Watts is a terrible person, I'm not trying to say that, like, he's always been an evil person. Like, that, you know, he didn't have any – you know, I don't think that their marriage was always, like, terrible or anything like that. You know, I think that for the most part – he was a fairly normal husband. And in this case, like, I think he got it, you know, and I think he did support her and he went along with these things that he didn't necessarily want to.
Right.
Because he just understood why she was doing it. All right. So as I mentioned, we open with the doorbell camera footage of Shanann coming back from that business trip at 1:48 a.m. on August 13th, 2018. Now, it was her friend Nicole Atkinson who went with her on the trip and dropped her off. And we have to talk about Nicole, who to me is the star of this entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody needs a friend like Nicole Atkinson. Because let me tell you, Chris Watts didn't have a chance to do shit because Nicole Atkinson was on the scene. Like, she was on the case. All right. So let's break this down. Now, she gets home at 1:48. She had a doctor's appointment. Shanann had a doctor's appointment at 9 a.m. Nicole knew this. So she, like, knew already. And it wasn't just a normal doctor's appointment. It was an OBGYN appointment. It was, like, an appointment because Shanann was pregnant.
Yes.
Now, Shanann was about 15 weeks pregnant at this time. So this was one of her very first OB appointments. Very exciting. Like, you get to see the ultrasound, you know, you get to listen to the heartbeat. Like, those early appointments are so...
This is not an appointment you would miss.
Exactly, exactly. Right. But she did. And so, you know, Nicole just started texting Shanann to be like, oh, hey, how did it go? Shanann, you know, didn't get back to her, which is very unlike her because, you know, she's the type of person who always had her phone, always got back to people, especially her friends. And so by like 11:30 or something, Nicole knew something was up.
Mm-hmm.
And like, God bless her, because we've talked several times in several episodes about how women don't want to feel like they're being hysterical or putting people out or making a big deal over nothing. And so they ignore their gut.
Right.
And, you know, they either put themselves in dangerous situations or, you know, put other people in dangerous situations, basically because, like, they don't want to be rude. And thankfully, Nicole did not subscribe to that. And she was like, no, this isn't right. Something's terribly wrong. And she called the cops.
Right.
Like 2.5 hours after she realized that Shanann didn't show up for a doctor's appointment, which I find amazing.
No, it's fantastic. I mean, especially when you consider missing persons investigations, like how quickly you need to respond to that, mm-hmm. and the faster the response is, the
better the outcome. Yes, typically, right?
Typically, the more likely you are to find the person.
Yeah.
Just on the face value of a missing person.
Right, and that doesn't always happen. I mean, we found that in the Terry Mahan case because there was also an immediate police response there and a very thorough search. And unfortunately, you know, that didn't get resolved. But in this case, you know, Nicole was on there, and this is when we start to see the first police body cam footage, and we really start to get a sense of what's going on. It's between 11:30 and noon, and Nicole is at the Watts house, and she's with her son, and she's freaking out. So the cop gets there and, you know, tries to talk to her a little bit about what's happening, but she doesn't live there. She's not a family member, so he can't go in the house.
Yeah, and that was that was one thing that I noticed right away. Such huge kudos to this cop that shows up to know exactly where the boundaries are, mm-hmm. as far as where what he can and can't do. Her son is following him around the house and even says it, like, why can't you just go in? And he even strictly says it. He's like, you know, specifically, I can't go in without consent of the owner.
Yeah.
And there are times when
Nicole
is on the phone.
Well, yeah. So she calls Shanann's parents.
Yes.
And is like, yo, your daughter's missing. We need to get in her house. Like, and granted, they can't really let them in the house anyway because it's her parents. They live in North Carolina. They don't have anything to do with the house.
It's not specific owner consent.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, but Shanann's mom is like, I give you permission to go into my daughter's house and figure out what's going on. You know, granted, she can't do that. But
well, she can do that to the friend.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool.
Well, yeah.
But the cop also stays outside until he gets specific consent from the owner.
Yes. And the owner, Chris Watts, does show up at that point. So he was at work. He gets called in and, you know, so comes in and goes into the house. So what he does, which you kind of touched on, is he opens the garage door. Mm-hmm. He sees that Shanann's car is still there. Mm-hmm. The two girls' car seats are still in that car. And he looks in the car. And then, you know, pops out and then goes into the house through the garage. He then comes around to the front door and opens the front door and lets everybody in. So they go in. The police officer, you know, does a basic just surface search. It's not like he has a search. He's not tossing the place. Like
it's a cursory search.
Yeah, it's a cursory search. He's just like literally like pulling back the shower curtain.
Yeah, he's just wandering around making sure there's like not a dead body, no blood. He doesn't know what's happening.
Yeah. And he's like asking Chris some kind of basic questions as he goes around. And, you know, like, are there any friends' houses where she could possibly be? Like, you know, did she pack a bag? And Chris says that the blankets are missing from his girls' rooms. They're blankies, not the blankets. So they're blankies that they sleep with are missing. So he mentions that. You know, and while they're there, I believe it's actually Nicole's son who finds Shanann's phone. And they find her phone, which is turned off. Mm-hmm. And they turn it back on. And Chris says something like, oh, man, this is her lifeline. Like, when this turns on, it's going to blow up with messages. And, you know, sure enough, it does. And
from both
From both Nicole and Chris. We see are a bunch of texts from both of them going like, hey, where are you? Where are you? What's going on? I haven't heard from you. I'm worried. So, you know, Nicole and Chris are texting her. Now, Chris says he also finds Shanann's wedding ring in their bedroom, which she, you know, usually wore. So he brings that out as like, oh, my goodness, this is weird. At this point, Chris is acting concerned about, one, the fact that her phone's there, two, the fact that the wedding ring is there, and three, the fact that the girl's blankies are missing. What he's kind of saying a little bit is like, oh, maybe, you know, Shanann kind of walked away and whatever. That's kind of seems like the seed he's trying to plant at that point. Right. But you noticed something really interesting.
Well, right away, the body cam footage shows the cop going into their bedroom and the bed isn't just unmade.
It's stripped.
Yeah. There's nothing on the bed.
Maybe like a mattress protector or something. Like there's something on the bed.
Sure. But there's no sheets.
Yeah.
There's no
blanket.
Yeah.
No pillows.
It's not. It didn't look like it was unmade from a hasty retreat from the house.
I find it interesting that the police officer doesn't mention that when he's looking through. Like, I don't know, because that would stick out to me. I think if I were seeing that and there was a missing person, that the bedding's all gone. He might I would have at least like asked a question.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe he was holding back.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe he saw it, realized it, and was holding back for the investigators to be like, hey,
that
might be a token to bring up later during the investigation, during the questioning.
Yeah. The next thing that happens is they go to the neighbor's house to see if he saw anything. And this guy is my second favorite person in this documentary. Okay, so this guy's name is Nate. And he, you know, like a lot of us, has surveillance cameras outside of his house. And, you know, he was like, oh, yeah, let me show you what I saw. And, you know, trying to just be a very helpful person. Like, he's obviously kind of freaked out by the cops being in his house and this woman who lives next door going missing. And so he shows the surveillance footage that he has from that morning. And he sees Chris's truck. And he's like, yeah, see, you can see him here, blah, 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 blah.
Back up into their driveway.
Yeah, and, you know, and Chris is like, oh, yeah, like, I stopped parking in the garage because, I don't know, like, he had this whole reason about, like, why his car was there instead of where it normally is, and something about people, like, things getting stolen out of cars.
But, yeah, and then he was, like, supposedly loading tools up or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I don't know. It doesn't matter. But the point is that what the thing that I found really interesting is that at this point, Chris Watts is a concerned husband whose wife and daughters are missing.
Right.
And this neighbor is showing surveillance footage that could possibly show something, whether it's Shanann leaving of her own free will or somebody like coming to get her or whatever it is. And Chris doesn't seem to watch the footage at all. Like at first he's on the phone and you know, when I pointed this out, you're like, well, you know, you don't know what he's doing on the phone. And you're right. It could have been something important. Who knows? But then like he got off the phone and just straight up was not watching the surveillance footage at all.
Right. No, he was directly looking at the cop.
Yeah. The whole time.
Didn't make eye contact with the neighbor. Mm-mm. Nothing. He was just looking directly at the cop.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, at this point, this is footage of what would have been, you know, him backing his vehicle into his driveway for whatever reason.
Well, yeah. No, I get that. But
so
like,
in theory, if he's going along with his story along the timeline, she's upstairs asleep.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't have shown anything.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, I totally would have been staring at that footage and being like,
was there, like, a car down the street watching her?
Did I miss something?
Yeah,
you know, because I'm loading my truck up to go to work. Did I miss something in the background? Was I not paying attention? Do I drive my truck away and then it shows her leaving right away?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he doesn't look at the
footage
at all.
Yeah, and so, you know, so this ends, and Goff does, like, the simple, like, oh, hey, you go on ahead. I'm just going to get his information, which right. I loved, which got Chris out of there in a very casual way.
Well, I mean, it's not – he does need to get his information for the report.
No, he does.
But
I think it was very obvious – I'm sure it was obvious to the cop because it was obvious to me that, like, that dude, Nate, had something more to say.
You always want to isolate whoever you're interviewing from anybody else.
Yeah.
So and that was a great way to do that.
Yeah, it was. And the second that door shut, Nate was like, that guy ain't acting right.
Yeah. I think that's exactly a direct quote. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and he went on. He's like, listen, this guy does not talk. Right. He is very quiet, very reserved. And he's like, he doesn't, like, bounce around like that. He was, like, talking nonstop. And, okay, to that end.
The cop even says it.
You don't, like, we'll imagine how he's feeling right now, the stress he's under,
and
et cetera,
we have said this several times.
You don't know how you're
going to
act.
Don't know how you're going to react.
And I know that I act very weird in stressful situations and probably in ways that people would find inappropriate. So I get that.
You get angry.
Yes, I do.
you do.
I do. You know. And I talk a lot. And whatever. Anyway, so I get that, but I just love that whole thing with the door shuts and then Nate was like,
"Oh no!" He immediately he's like, "This isn't right." Mm-mm. Yeah.
Okay. So after this, the investigation kind of goes on, and now we can talk a lot about the whole media and cops paying more attention to missing white women than they do other groups. And Shanann was a very pretty missing white woman. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she also went missing with two small children, which right. I think, you know, will get you.
That's going to up the ante.
It will. Yeah. But do I think race and class, like, was a part of this? Absolutely. Do I think that the fact that, you know, they were a kind of picture-perfect TV family, like, had something to do with this? Absolutely. Like, I do. That's the world that we live in. And, no, yeah. It's not right. But what I will say is that, you know, any time a missing person can get police and media attention, it's good. Yes, it's bad that not everybody gets the same level. But Shanann did get a high level. And, you know, they showed, like, they were doing door-to-door canvassing. They were doing roadblocks, it looked like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the police response to this.
It was intense. It was fast.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And they showed newscasts saying this was a small town. And mm-hmm. I don't know the geography of
Frederick.
Colorado. So maybe it is a small town. I have no idea. They're incorporated at least because they have their own police department. Mm-hmm. But my God, the response to that was just amazing.
And this got a lot of media attention and went national very quickly. And that's actually the first time I remember hearing about this was when Chris Watts was on his front porch kind of doing the typical family plea for the missing people to come home. And, you know, he said, like, please, Shanann, come home. Like, the house isn't the same without you and the girls, whatever it was he said. And the very first time I heard about this case is because people are like, that guy is creepy. Like, there's something wrong with that guy. Like, he does not sound right. And again, I always take that with a huge grain of salt. Like,
right.
That, you know, doesn't mean anything. But yeah, hindsight, you look at him, like, he has, like, dead eyes. Like, dead, weird shark eyes when he's saying that. The investigation is going on. You know, but obviously they're sticking kind of close to home, right? And they have to look at Chris as the number one suspect because he is the most likely suspect. You know, they're trying to determine if Shanann even was a victim of foul play, though, because she's a grown woman. She very well could have had a fight with her husband and just left. That mm-hmm. happens. And it turns out that it is kind of likely because as we find out in the documentary, their marriage wasn't exactly kind of Facebook picture perfect. They had been having problems mm-hmm. leading up to her disappearance in August. you know, there was the infamous Santa Claus video, which we should probably talk about, because I remember the first time that I watched this with you, like, you had an immediate visceral reaction to watching that.
Yeah. So he shows up to the front door dressed as Santa Claus, and I guess things didn't go exactly as planned.
Yeah, because she was using her phone to do the Facebook Live, and she wanted his phone to take photos.
Oh, I didn't realize it was Facebook Live.
I believe it was, yeah.
Okay, okay. So her immediate response when she opened the door was, "Where's your phone?"
Mm-hmm.
And he was taken aback and kind of stunned and was like, "It's in the garage?"
Yeah.
And she was very annoyed by all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell.
Yeah, I could tell that she was stressed out.
Yeah.
And, like, had been planning this and was trying to make it happen. And from her perspective, he had a very small job and he wasn't doing it and everything was on her. And from your perspective, you were, like, kind of seeing it from his perspective a little bit, I think.
Yeah. Like, he's dressed as Santa.
Yeah.
I left my phone somewhere else, where his mindset is like, I'm going to surprise my kids.
Yeah.
And
you know, I do believe this was a Facebook Live, and this is probably an example of one of those things that he didn't really want to do in the first place, but agreed to it. And then she's getting on him about, like, not having his phone. And, you know, it was just shown in the documentary, I think, to kind of give an overview of the relationship, because Shanann does say that, like, she's the dominant one in the relationship.
Yes.
And this very much shows that, like, he kind of just went along with things. Mm-hmm. And in interviews with people who knew him, who knew them, like, they say that's how he always was. Like, he's always been just a kind of go with the flow type of person.
Yeah.
I did read something that said, like, during her first marriage, she was kind of, like, in a very submissive role.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this marriage, it kind of flipped. And that their marriage, Shanann and Chris's marriage, really reflected and mirrored Shanann's parents' marriage, where Shanann's father was kind of more submissive and Shanann's mother was the one who was kind of, you know, the driving force in the marriage. And so, you know, that's definitely at play throughout this entire thing. And yeah.
Right. And the documentary even goes into it at a certain point, talking about Chris's mom
mm-hmm.
being the dominant one in the family, mm-hmm. and described as controlling.
Yeah.
And psychologically speaking, going from his perspective, because that led to a downfall in their relationship, was that Chris's parents did not necessarily approve
of Shanann.
Of Shanann.
Yeah, and that's
an, because they said she was controlling and she was mm-hmm. taking him away from them.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently his mom, like, really never forgave Shanann for, right, quote, taking him away. And, you know, and she did. I mean, to be fair, like, she kind of physically did. Right,
sure,
like, she did take him away to Colorado. But
those competing viewpoints mm-hmm. show the same dominant personality
mm-hmm.
coming to a head.
Yeah.
You know, so you have somebody that is controlling in Chris's life, mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then Shanann comes in and is a controlling person in Chris's life. And then Chris and Shanann leave.
Mm-hmm. And that did lead to many problems throughout their marriage. I mean, it started at the very beginning when Chris's parents didn't even show up to their wedding.
Right.
And, I mean, that's
that
huge.
That is huge.
To just say you're straight up not coming to the wedding because you don't approve. I mean, that's a bold statement. And, you know, I don't know how you can really expect to kind of have a happy, like, kind of family situation after that. But apparently they did, because that summer, Shanann actually decided to go to North Carolina for 6 weeks mm-hmm. to visit both of their families. So she was primarily going to visit her own family, but, you know, Chris's family lived right there, and she was with the grandkids, and, you know, all the grandparents want to see the grandkids. But there was an incident where Chris's mom had some sort of nut. I don't remember if it was peanuts or cashews or whatever it was that she knew that one of the kids was allergic to. Mm-hmm. And had it there anyway, and Shanann freaked out and
it wasn't just there. Like, she fed it to the kids.
No, she wasn't. No. Because Shanann was on the kids like a hawk. Like, she doesn't just allow, like, things to be fed. No. If she had fed it, like, it would have been, really bad. Oh, okay. No, it didn't get to that point.
Okay.
But Shanann was like, what are you doing? Like, she could literally die. You know, what are you thinking? And Chris's mom, like, was one of those people who's like, oh, I'm sure it's not that big of a deal. Like, I'm sure the allergy isn't that big of a deal. And so that kind of led to, like, this huge blow up where Shanann's like, listen, you can't be around my kids anymore. And, you know, she was looking to her husband to kind of back her up, and he just kind of didn't. It's not like he sided with his parents either. He just kind of
let it go.
He just didn't get involved at all.
Okay, so it's important to note that we are not villainizing anybody at this point, aside from Chris. Mm-hmm. Chris's mom seemed to be controlling.
Mm-hmm.
Shanann seemed to be controlling.
Mm-hmm.
So from a psychological perspective, from Chris, it seems as though the way he has lived his life, as everybody has described him, being the type of person that doesn't talk a lot, doesn't really – he's maybe introverted, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He just kind of goes with the flow of whatever the current authority figure is.
Yeah.
So being caught between two authority figures, i.e. his mom and his wife – he probably just kind of acquiesced to both of them, said whatever he needed to say to both of them
mm-hmm.
to get them off of his back
mm-hmm.
to kind of keep the peace.
Mm-hmm. I mean, not that it was successful at all.
Well, like, no, but that's, you know.
But no, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's what he was trying to do.
And that kind of goes with his personality.
Yeah, he's kind of like conflict averse. And would just rather go along with something that he doesn't necessarily, like, want to go along with rather than fight about it. And I don't think he wanted to fight with his mom or his wife.
And this develops later. This is the psychology that develops mm-hmm. later into what probably led to him, spoiler alert, killing his wife.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of problems between Shanann and Chris. And this whole thing with his parents was a big, big part of it. You know, but a lot of it was just normal kind of marriage stuff. It was distance, right? Like, you saw in the documentary that Shanann was just complaining that Chris felt distant, that it was emotionally one-sided, mm-hmm. you know, the relationship, that it was all Shanann putting in the effort, that he wasn't, and he kept on saying, and I think what you just brought up is really interesting, where you were kind of saying that he was just saying whatever he needed to say to, like, avoid a conflict, and thinking about that, looking back on the texts that you see in the documentary, where he's like, oh, no, baby, like, it's not it. I'm so sorry.
No,
like,
you're placating.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's all just like he's saying what he thinks she needs to hear to not be mad at him.
Right.
You know, he's not addressing any underlying issues.
Right.
He's not having any sort of honest conversation, which she's trying to have with him. Like, she's trying.
And there is evidence in the way the texts are written
mm-hmm.
and the way it's presented in the documentary that she is somebody that has been to therapy
mm.
because some of the phrases that she mentions in texts, whether it's to Chris or to her friend,
mm-hmm.
It's always centered around, like, I know that I'm pushy. I realize that, and I realize that I need to work on that. And mm-hmm. and it's that's not something that does not come about without self-reflection. Mm. And I don't think you get to that point where you realize your flaws without going to therapy. Mm. And so I think that she was somebody that probably went to therapy, probably after her first marriage fell apart. Mm. So I think she knows psychologically, like, I realize I am controlling to an extent, I'm overbearing, however you want to describe it, but I'm working on that. And she keeps coming back around to inviting him back in.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's something that I don't think Chris was familiar with. Mm. So I don't know whether he knew how to take that. I think that he is the type of person, just judging on what, again, I don't know his family history. I'm going strictly off of what I saw on the Netflix special. It looks to me like he is somebody that was controlled mm-hmm. and was used to just burying his feelings and going along with whatever was happening and compartmentalizing so that he could get by however he could.
I mean, that's really interesting. And I kind of looked at it from that perspective, but not really. But I think you're right. You know, like, this is, it's really a guy who doesn't seem to have made a ton of decisions in his life.
Correct.
You know?
Right.
He's just whatever kind of people told him to do, he just did.
Right.
I think it's clear that Shanann's trying to have conversations with him. He's not receptive to them, whether he doesn't care or, more likely, he just doesn't know how to do it.
He doesn't know how to process it.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, but in either case, she's not getting anywhere with him. And when he finally comes down to North Carolina, after she's been there for 5 weeks, they spend a week together, and there's clearly a very strong disconnect. And you can see it in the video that she's taking at the airport mm-hmm. when he's coming, and none of them have seen him in 5 weeks.
Right.
And, you know, and her focus and his focus, as it should be, is with the kids, mm-hmm. right? Because the kids haven't seen him, so the whole thing is like, all right, let's see the kids. Kids, let's see daddy. And that's great, but, like, he barely even says hi to her, mm-hmm. you know, and she obviously notices that, and she talks about that in texts with a friend later. But I mean, it's very obvious. Like,
right.
I mean, you and I, you know, and they've been married at this point around the same amount of time you and I have been married, like, you know, 6-7 years, whatever it is, 5-6. I don't know how long they've been married or how long we've been married for that matter, but
everything's a blur at this point.
Who knows? Yeah. Somewhere between 1 and 100. But we've never been apart for nearly that long. But no. I can't imagine. I mean, I can imagine, like, yes, kids first, but then also, like, hey.
Yeah. No, totally.
Hi, I haven't seen you in 5 weeks. Like, what's up? And yeah, there's, like, a very clear chasm mm-hmm. in their marriage at that point. And, you know, this apparently continues for that whole week they're together in North Carolina. Like, you know, they're at the beach. It's just not going well. Like, there's this distance. She doesn't know why. She kind of thinks that maybe he's cheating, but also says to her friend, like, that probably can't be it because he has no game.
Yeah, and we can get into that with his whole weight loss and everything else. Yeah,
so let's actually, I think now is actually a good time to start getting into that. Yeah. So let's talk about that. Now, Chris, over the past year, like, it was really just that year. I mean, this wasn't a super long-term thing. Like, it was a fairly sudden transformation.
The weight loss?
Yeah, lot of it, he actually does attribute to those Thrive patches. He kept on wearing them and was like, oh, my God, I can't stop moving. I can't stop, like, working out. I can't stop, like, vacuuming the house, you know. Mm. And he said it gave him a ton of energy. He worked out constantly. Like, he had this, like, big this whole routine, right? And I have read some things about these patches. I'm not saying, I don't know, like, please, LaVille, don't sue me or whatever. But, like, some of the reviews say that, like, it makes them feel very speedy.
Oh.
And just a little, like, yeah, crazy. So regardless, he was using these. He was exercising all the time. He lost a ton of weight. He got ripped. And
he did, yeah.
And when I'm watching it for the first time and you're out of town and, you know, listen, we're all in quarantine. You and I, when we started staying home in March, like immediately gained 10 pounds each.
Oh, yeah.
Like immediately.
I mean, that's being nice saying that I only gained 10 pounds.
Well, no, like we both do, like, because we were drinking and I ate more grilled cheeses in, like, the months of March and April.
Well,
than
to be
I think
fair, I make the best grilled cheese.
You make the best. But, like, I ate more grilled cheeses in those, like, the first 2 months than I think I had in the last 2 years combined. And so we both gained weight. And so, like, it's been, like, a whole thing, you know, because we couldn't go to the gym and we were just eating all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was this whole thing. And we got the Peloton and whatever. But we've been having a lot of conversations of, like, oh, like, we need to, like, eat better. We need to work out more. We need to do this, that, and the other. And then you're out of town. I'm watching this documentary. This dude who's, you know, a dad, like, starts getting ripped.
Yeah, okay, but he dropped, like, 90 pounds.
Okay, whatever. I don't care how many pounds he dropped. He got ripped. Like, he had a crazy six-pack.
Yeah.
He had, like, whatever muscles there are. I don't know. And
Hey, look, he did an amazing job.
He did.
He was completely
ripped. I immediately texted you. I'm like, this is it. Like, like, this is why you can't work out, because you will, one, cheat on me, and two, murder me. And I'm not here for that.
Okay. Okay, well, to be fair, I will never murder you because, look, I've been divorced twice. like, there is life after divorce. And you know, all jokes aside, and you know, the prosecuting attorney even says this. If you get to that point in your marriage where there's cheating, where you want to be with somebody else, divorce is an option.
Yeah, no, you cannot trust a dad with that many abs. Like, you just can't. Like, you know that there's something shady going on. Like, there's no way that dude's just, like, an okay, like, upstanding guy. Like, there's just zero. I'm not saying they're always murderers. I'm saying there's always something wrong with them, though. Always.
I'll keep that in mind. I'll you know, adjust my workout schedule accordingly.
Yeah. So here's the interesting thing about that. You know, he got ripped.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, he started getting kind of more female attention.
Right.
So Shanann's fears, her thoughts, like all of that stuff in the back of her head was right, because mm-hmm. Chris had been having an affair with a coworker named Nicole Kessinger. And police found out about this, not from Chris, mm-hmm. who stringently denied ever having an affair or ever having any sort of inappropriate relationship. They found out from Nicole, who came down to the police station. Was like, hi, by the way, I've been watching the news. I saw that Shanann and her two kids are missing. I am sleeping with her husband.
Also, she had been lied to.
Okay, well, so about that.
That's, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was that misrepresented during the... Okay, go.
Yeah, so...
Go.
It's really kind of a question of who you want to believe on this. Nicole did tell investigators that she was under the impression that Chris and Shanann were separated,
mm-hmm.
And that they were in the process of a divorce, that it was an amicable mutual agreement, and everything was fine, but, you know, like, these things take time and whatever. Chris told the FBI in 2019 that basically that was a lie. Nicole did know that he wasn't separated, but, you know, that he told her that he wanted to get separated, that they wanted to split up, but that she basically told that to the police to kind of save face, to make her seem like not somebody who was sleeping with a married man.
Mm-hmm.
But as I'll get to later, Chris apparently also lied about other things in that FBI interview, so who knows. The point is that Nicole kind of came on to him at work. Like, they kind of started talking, they worked together and whatever, and it was friendly, and then it kind of just crossed the line. And mm-hmm. from his perspective, Nicole came on to him, and that is not something that had really happened to him before. Mm-hmm. And so it was new. Like, he was not used to being the one who was pursued. And so this was exciting for him. And, you know, I think that in and of itself really contributed to his infatuation with Nicole.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, now,
and let's take his mental perspective at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say basically being controlled, but acquiescing to
a stronger
female personality. And then you have presumably another strong female personality coming in and pursuing him.
Mm-hmm. And so he actually does say in this FBI interview – you know, so I think some very illuminating things where he's just like, I never thought about what I had to say with her. Like, she would ask my opinion on things. You know, she, like, it just sounded like the dynamic was very different, right? And she, not that she took a submissive role necessarily, but, you know, she did ask his opinion and do things that Shanann didn't necessarily do. And it kind of fed his ego a little bit.
Yeah.
And so you've got this guy who's, you know, in his mid-30s, who is, you know, who's recently changed his appearance, who is experiencing this female attention from an attractive woman, you know, and that's not in a way that he hasn't experienced it before.
Right.
And, yeah, and suddenly he's starting to think, oh, my goodness, there's a whole new world out here. Like, my life could be different.
You can understand where he's coming from, where he could get enticed by that.
Well, absolutely. And I think what's also important to know, and what is not actually explicitly covered in the documentary, is the timeline. So this relationship between him and Nicole was very hot and heavy, very fast. And it just started up, coincidentally, right before Shanann took the girls to North Carolina. So Chris meets this woman at work, things start happening, and then all of a sudden, he doesn't have a wife or kids to deal with on a daily basis.
And also he's experiencing the pressure of having a third child coming.
Yeah.
And that's relatively new around that same point.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. So, like, he had just found out that Shanann was pregnant at this point. So then he's got this third baby on the way. He has two kids. He's got this wife. They're all gone. And all of a sudden, it's just him and this new woman who, like, tells him how hot he is all the time and, like, thinks that he's interesting and probably laughs at all his dumb jokes and, like, you know, is giving him the stuff that his wife isn't giving him. And because his wife isn't there, so I read this in a separate thing, and this isn't said in the documentary, he basically spent that entire 5 weeks, like, every single night at her apartment.
Yeah, and the documentary kind of alludes to it, but mm-hmm. it doesn't specifically say that.
Of course. And so I think what happens in this, you know, 5 week period where Shanann's in North Carolina is he just kind of is in this alternate reality, mm-hmm. right? So he's in this alternate reality where he's free of a wife and kids, and he can do what he wants, and he can be with this woman. And he doesn't have those daily responsibilities.
Right.
And, you know, yeah, you can see how that's appealing.
Yeah.
And the thing is like, he just doesn't seem to come back to Earth.
That's where the problem is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean.
There's a lot of problems.
There's a lot of problems. But
yeah, but no, he just doesn't seem to come back to Earth. And so once they return from North Carolina And like they kind of get back into that daily life and that daily routine. And, you know, you're parenting and the kids are waking up in the morning and in the middle of the night and you're watching Peppa Pig and like, you know, you get back into that life. It's like, I think he started to feel trapped,
right,
and didn't make the logical, like, oh, maybe I just need to get out of here. Maybe I just need to talk and have an honest conversation with my wife, because right, he seems incapable of having an honest conversation.
Right. That's where the problem is.
Yeah.
I think that he is 100% conflict avoidance. So if you are 100% conflict avoidance and you're put in this situation where you have a potential out,
mm-hmm,
you're not going to bring it up.
Well, exactly. And so I think that's what kind of leads to this, because, okay, if he tells Shanann that he met somebody else, mm-hmm, that he wants a divorce, or even if he just lies and says that, you know, it's just they're not compatible.
Right.
Either way, she's 15 weeks pregnant. He's a shithead. Like, there's no scenario in which
he doesn't come out as a good guy.
Exactly.
In any of this.
Right. There's no scenario in which anyone other than his parents, who already don't like her, like, think that he's just not a shithead. And he comes out as a bad guy. Like, he's a bad guy in this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he's like, then I'm sure he's thinking, okay, then what? Like, how does this work financially? What do we do with the house? What do we do with the kids? And it's all just answers that he doesn't have. And so what I think happens, you know, whether it's consciously or subconsciously at this point, is if they were just gone, then everything would be fine. Everything could go back to the way it was in the 5 weeks when they were in North Carolina. I wouldn't be the bad guy. They would be gone and I could live my life.
Yeah, but that's not real.
No, it's not real.
Right.
It's not real at all. But this dummy thought it was.
Right. And, you know, I said it before, I'll say it again. If you get to that point, there are solutions. Even if you can't see them.
Yeah.
There's life ahead of you, you know?
It's never as bad as it seems when you're in it.
No, look, your
wouldn't
parents...
this be a really great time to, like, drop in an ad for a divorce lawyer? Like, if this whole thing was, like, a paid advertisement.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, shit happens in people's lives.
Yeah.
You know? I said it. I've been divorced twice.
Mm-hmm.
Shit happens.
Yeah.
You find your way out of it.
And a big part of this does seem to be Shanann's pregnancy, you know, because it's like, how do you leave a woman who's 15 weeks pregnant? You know, how can he start his new life with Nicole when he's got a baby on the way? Like, and
you figure it out.
Exactly.
That's what it comes down to.
So getting back to the case, though, I have been accused by my sister, who likes being mentioned on this podcast, but I've been accused of, like, coming off as very anti-cop in this show. And what I think is funny is when I was watching it, I was, like, super pro-cop. And then you pointed out something that I should have caught but didn't, and was actually kind of a no-no. So, all right, I want to get to the interrogation of Chris Watts,
okay,
which when I was watching it the first time, I was like, this is genius. Like, these people are great at their jobs. So, you know, they were talking about the basic, like, all the normal questions you would expect to be asked. Like we said, you know, do you have a girlfriend, which you lied about? You know, and I loved the one detective was like, lost a lot of weight. What's that about? And he's like, a lot of times when dudes lose weight, it's because, like, they're sleeping with somebody else, which I was like, yeah, that's what I'm saying. The detectives are, in my opinion, like, asking just very normal, smart questions or whatever, trying to, like, be friendly with him, trying to get him to open up. Then he takes the polygraph,
mm-hmm,
which, dear God, why would this dummy take a polygraph? Like, I was listening to one description of this and they were like, that polygrapher did not even need to plug the machine in.
No.
Oh my God. It was such a disaster. And I've said this before. I said in the Toni Sharpless case, when her friends, like, volunteered to take a polygraph, like, I've never murdered anybody, but I can 100% guarantee that if I took a polygraph, I would admit, like, I would 100% be found guilty of killing somebody. Like, I would fail any polygraph so badly. And so this ding dong did murder people and still agreed to take it. Thinking what? I don't know.
I don't know. He was
a hot mess.
Probably thinking that he was going to be able to pass it. And that would suck.
Given the fact that he doesn't show emotion.
Or if he didn't pass it, at the very least, he could be like, well, I didn't. Because we know polygraphs are not admissible. In court.
Yeah, of course.
So he could, at the very least, be like, well, I didn't. He could use that saying, I was willing to take a polygraph.
Right.
One of the things I wanted to mention was, because I took notes while we were watching this. And you said it specifically about the weight loss. Mm-hmm. They already knew that he had been cheating.
Yeah.
So even when that first cop, before the polygraph was even happening, the first investigator was like, you know, I see you now before me, and you're pretty cut. And then Chris goes on to talk about how he was 285, and now he's 180 something, whatever. Yeah. He already knew. Mm-hmm. Because then he mentions, he brings up the cheating. He gives him like the soft indicator of like, this is your way, kind of your way out.
Yeah.
Not your way out, but like.
But no, he was just trying to get him to open up.
Yeah. Then let's get to the polygraph.
Yeah.
And the detective giving the polygraph, quote, I hope that if you did have something to do with her disappearance, ... you'd be really dumb to take this polygraph. That's literally what she said. You'd be really dumb to do this.
That was my favorite part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, and she said it in such a sweet way, too. Like, she's so understanding and so caring. She's like, you know, you'd just be really dumb.
Just be really dumb to do this. Yeah. So the way a polygraph works, you give a bunch of base questions. If we haven't covered this already, you give out a bunch of base questions. Things that you know the answer to.
Yeah. What is your name? Where were you born?
Right. To give a baseline of how the reactions of your body are spiking the system. Now, again, this is not an exact science. It really isn't. Mm-mm. Polygraphy is not an exact science, which is why it's not admissible in court. However, this is what we go with. One of the questions, which again, is a softball, should have been very easy to answer.
I know which question you're talking about. Quote,
before 2018, have you ever said anything out of anger to a loved one? Chris's response, yes. No.
No.
He said that was, yes. No. As though he had already fucked up the polygraph.
I know. It was so bad.
Hey. Here's a clue. That's a baseline question. They were expecting yes.
Yeah.
Because, yeah.
Literally everybody.
Everybody has said something out of anger to somebody that they love in their entire life.
Yeah.
Look, we have a 3-year-old and he says things out of anger to us every fucking day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's a baseline question to gauge your response.
And he couldn't even get that right.
When he said yes, no, that was it. That's done. He already failed the polygraph right there. It's like, okay.
Like, you can just turn it off.
I don't need to even ask you any more fucking questions. You're already guilty. You've just admitted to killing your fucking wife. You know, like, what a complete idiot. But I will say this as far as the investigators go. I think that they looked into it psychologically the exact same way that I looked into it. Mm-hmm. I think there's a reason why the initial investigation was a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then
they brought the woman in.
Mm-hmm. Because I think they looked into his background. They did the research behind the Facebook posts, the text messaging, everything that they concluded the exact same thing that we did here was that he is generally submissive to a dominant female role.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought.
But she couldn't be too dominant, right?
No. It's got to be.
Exactly, because she, the detective, she was rubbing his back at one point.
Yes.
Like, she was straight up calling him a dummy because he is, but like was also being very like, hey, like, it's just time to tell me.
Right.
Like, you gotta do it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about her though, because that's the part that I should have caught and I didn't, and you did. So I thought this was genius where toward the end of the part of the because obviously there's a lot of the interrogation that we don't see in the documentary, but part of the, toward the end of what we do see, she starts to give him an out because she's trying to get him to say, like, what happened, and he's not telling her. He's not admitting to it. He's just still saying, like, oh, I don't know why I feel like boo-boo-boo-boo. I don't know why I feel the polygraph. I swear I didn't do anything to them. And it's, like, so obvious he's lying, but he's she can't get him there. And so she gives him an out, and she says, well, what happened? Did Shadan do something to the kids?
Right.
And she does that, and then he doesn't say anything, and that's when he asks to talk to his dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so she leaves, and from my perspective, I'm like, oh, my God, she gave him an out. Now he's not going to be the bad guy. Now he can just say, like, he can admit to it, but, like, find it in a way that's – and do it in a way that's going to save face because it's all about his ego. And then you pointed out something very important. This technique that she was using is the same technique that has led to a billion false confessions.
Yeah, so it's the Reed interrogation technique. It is – incredibly effective on a guilty person.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly. For that very reason that you were just talking about. It does, in fact, give them an out. Gives them a way to assuage their guilt, however that may be, by giving them a shoulder to lean on, an understanding story behind why they did what they did.
Mm-hmm.
It's very effective. If you're guilty, it's also very effective, unfortunately, if you are not guilty and you are just literally looking to get out of that room.
Yeah.
Now, in this particular situation, in this instance, I think the Netflix special said that he had been interrogated for eight hours.
He said like 5 to 6 hours.
Okay, 5 to 6 hours. Which actually, in the terms of
it, isn't that long.
It's not that long.
Yeah.
But you've got to think. Think about you sitting in an interrogation room for 5 to 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now let's amplify this by you being innocent and adamantly denying everything and going on for 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's amplify it by saying something like,
You're young.
You're young.
You're mentally disabled.
Correct.
You know, you have other factors going on.
And you're not as good of an interrogator as this woman was, where you're saying things where you can't connect with the person. And you're saying things like, all you need to do to go home.
Right,
to
right.
To see your mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
You just got to tell me what happened.
Yeah. And then they start saying, well, so, you know, things like, oh, well, you just got to tell me what happened. Like, you went to the store. Yeah. You were just going to buy something.
We understand.
But something
this
happened.
This is what happened.
And
yeah.
then you ended up shooting the clerk. Like, you know.
Right.
Like, it's, yeah. So they kind of build the story for them. And she does do that to an extent. So he does ask to talk to his father. And, you know, within what seems like a few minutes, I'm not exactly sure because, you know, we are watching a documentary.
Right.
But he seemingly very quickly tells the story that the cop gave to him, which is he talked to and she didn't – I shouldn't even say that she gave it to him because she planted the seed of the story. And the seed of the story was that Shanann is the one who did something to the kids and then he killed Shanann. So he takes that and kind of runs with it. And he says to his father that he had this conversation with Shanann, that he told her that he wanted a separation. She got mad. She strangled the children. And then he flew into a rage and strangled her.
Right.
And, you know, the dad's like, oh, wow, yeah. Like, he had a very, very calm reaction to all this.
Yeah. So that's the reason why I wanted you to
find
out what he did for a living, because it almost seemed like when he got into the room that he kind of planted the seed also of did Shanann do something to the kids.
Right. And I think
– because
– I think that – but I don't think that has anything to do with what he did for a living. I think it has everything to do with the fact that
– that he wanted to protect his son.
That, yeah, that they – no, I think he generally – like genuinely doesn't think that he could have done anything wrong. He's seen Shanann as a villain for years.
Oh, that's true.
Right, and so he's thinking, so in his mind, that probably is the most logical conclusion, that Shanann did something to drive him to this.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of where he was coming from in that moment. But so anyway, so he tells that story. But whatever it is, bullshit story or not, it's enough. It's enough of a confession that, like, it's over. He's going to jail. So the whole proceeding starts, things go on, his story evolves. Although I do want to say, you know, first, before he, this interrogation ends, like, that detective was like, are you sure this is really what you want to do? Like, you want to go out and publicly say that your wife killed your children? She's, because she was, like, even though she's the one who kind of, like, gave him that idea, she's still like, are you really going to be this much of a piece of shit? And he's like, yes. I was born in the shadows. Like, I'm going to be this piece of shit forever. And he does. And so he goes out and he's, and that's a story that Shanann killed the kids. He killed Shanann because he was, you know, avenging his children's death or whatever. So that's what it goes. He goes to trial. Then he ends up pleading guilty.
Right.
And he ends up pleading guilty, for several reasons that he says. And but in the course of pleading guilty, he admits that he killed all of them.
Right.
The initial story that he gives is basically that Shanann came home. They ended up having sex. Then they fell asleep. The next morning, you know, she woke up and he was just feeling like, oh, I can't do this anymore. He has the conversation about wanting a separation. She, you know, freaks out, whatever it is, and then he ends up strangling her. The kids wake up, and he ends up taking Shanann's body, putting her in the truck. He puts the kids in the back seat of the truck with her, drives them down to the oil field where he worked, dumps Shanann's body, smothers the children, and puts them in the oil rigs.
Right.
And that story is the same basic story that he tells the FBI in that interview I mentioned before the following February. He also tells the FBI basically what we talked about, that, you know, he just couldn't find a way out, that he wanted to start this new life. He couldn't figure it out. He felt like he was kind of on this roller coaster and he couldn't figure out a way to get off of it. And that this is the solution he came up with, that it wasn't premeditated. But that might not actually be true. One thing that we've seen from the documentary, from all of the news reports, is that it's hard to nail down what is objectively true and what Chris Watts might think is true in the moment, or what he might simply want people to believe about him.
Which is typical behavior of somebody that compartmentalizes their lives.
Yeah, and this FBI interview was in February of 2019. At this time, you know, Chris had already been put in prison. You know, the trial was over. He had actually been moved to Wisconsin out of Colorado. Mm-hmm. And was getting a lot of mail and things like that. One of the people who started writing him was a woman named Sherilyn Cadle. And they wrote back and forth, and she actually visited him several times. And, you know, to the point where he put her on the visitor list. He wrote her several letters, and she took these visits and letters and turned them into a book. In a news article that was just released in October of 2020, so just last month, it has one of the letters that he wrote to her. And in this letter, he goes into detail about the events that led up to the murders and what actually happened that day. If we haven't already given you an idea of the type of disconnect and compartmentalization that this guy has, I'm just going to read you the opening paragraph of this letter, which was dated April 23rd, 2019. Dear Sherilyn, hello again. I hope you are doing well. It's been awesome being able to talk with you on the phone, but I know the 15-minute time limit is a pain. Sometimes I can get right back on the phone, but right now there are other inmates that like to be on the phone as much as I do, so I respect their time as well. How's your dad doing? I hope you're able to see him. I've been praying on that every day. This is the opening.
So he's already trying to come across as this genuinely nice guy.
Yeah, and his whole thing is like he's found God in prison, and he's like trying to be a chaplain, and he agreed to let her like publish this book as long as she would tell people that he's found God and has achieved forgiveness or whatever. But we need to go further into this letter. We'll link to this on the website, but I honestly don't want to read this verbatim. He does detail what happened, and he actually numbers like the different steps of what happened. But there are a couple things from here that I will mention. Apparently, when Shanann's autopsy was done, they found oxycodone in her system, which, you know, as you know, is not something that should be in a pregnant woman's system at all.
Right.
In this, he says, the reason the medical examiner found OxyContin in Shanann's system is because I gave it to her. I thought it would be easier to be with Nicole if Shanann wasn't pregnant. So he gave her Oxy basically in hopes of inducing a miscarriage.
So he says that he gave it to her that night.
See, this is the thing, because he even contradicts himself. Cato asked him about the claims, because I guess this had already been kind of like public. And he said that he had given it to her twice initially. So once at her parents. So when they were in North Carolina, he gave it to her to try to make her have a miscarriage. And then he says, oh, wait, no, I only gave it to her once.
It's worth noting drugs of that nature only stay in your system for 72 hours.
Mm.
It's not like weed that stays in your system for a month.
I think that's interesting, though. So it was found in her system. And so let's say that at least the story of him giving it to her the night before is true. That actually goes along with what her father said at the documentary, where
the defensive wounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
He said, I have to believe that she was asleep.
That was my initial
because
reaction.
Because she would have fought back.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she didn't fight back. And this very much could be why. So what it sounds like to me is he gave it to her the first time in order to induce a miscarriage, but then gave it to her the second time because he knew he was going to kill her. And he goes on in that letter to say that this was something he'd been thinking about for a couple weeks.
Hmm.
And he knew even that he was going to kill his girls before. So he talks about the day of the 12th and what they did that day. And then he says, quote, I always enjoyed taking the girls places or playing outside because it was our opportunity to bond. And still, even the night before, I couldn't stop myself from what I knew would occur the next morning. End quote. But the worst part of what he reveals in this letter is that the order that he told the interrogators isn't the actual order of what happened, according to this. He said that it wasn't Shanann that he killed first, that he went into his girls' rooms and he smothered them both with a pillow. He went back to his room. He killed his wife. But then his girls woke up. He hadn't finished the job, and he said that they both had bruises on their face and they looked like they had been traumatized. And they saw Shanann, and they asked what was wrong, and he put them in the truck, just like he said, took them out to the oil field and finished the job. So not only did he kill his wife and two kids, he basically killed his girls twice.
And had a long stretch of time
to think about it. In between.
Mm-hmm. On November 6, 2018, Chris Watts pleaded guilty to the murders. On November 19th, he was sentenced to 5 life sentences without the possibility of parole. He received an additional 48 years for the unlawful termination of Shanann's pregnancy and 36 years for 3 charges of tampering with the deceased body. On December 3rd of 2018, he was moved to an out-of-state location due to security concerns. He is now residing at a maximum security prison in Wisconsin, where he's going to live out the rest of his days. But Shanann, Bella, and Cecilia won't have that opportunity. All of the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos, on our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at @ATTWGPod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Conan Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.